there's a lot of fear around AI in the film industry. What's happening right now as you kind of take a look at kind of a blanketed approach and what's happening within that space?
Yeah, it is such an important issue that that's why I wrote my most recent book, Honest Creativity, because I saw so much anxiety amongst the creative class. And I think that anxiety has since crossed over into computer programmers and, you know, accountants and financial analysts and lawyers. And I think we're all dealing with it a little bit. With the film industry, to a large degree, the strike, the recent strike was really about that. That was screenwriters not wanting to be replaced. That's actors saying, you can't use my likeness without my permission. You have to pay me.
Well, I only would ever use the word Christian as a noun, not an adjective. So in a sense, I would say there's no such thing as Christian media or Christian music. There's music made by Christians. Okay, you distinguish that. But otherwise, you're just kind of using a marketing term, I think, that is distancing and maybe creates a false divide in our minds. Because I also don't want to separate my Sunday morning experience from my, you know, Monday to Saturday experience.
Welcome to the Upwards Podcast, where we discuss the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace. Today, I'm talking with Craig Detweiler, an author, filmmaker, and cultural commentator based in Los Angeles. He writes about culture, theology, and technology. He also writes screenplays and produces films. He received an MFA in cinema TV production from the University of Southern California, and a Master's of Divinity and PhD in Theology and Culture from Fuller Theological Seminary. He currently serves as the Dean of the College of Arts and Media at Grand Canyon University. In this episode, we discuss the integration of faith in filmmaking, the transformative power of storytelling, and how technology, AI, and human creativity can bring the best out of all of us. Now, on to the conversation. Well, welcome, Craig, to the podcast. Theologian, filmmaker, academic. We love all those things here at Upper House, and so excited to have you on the podcast today with us. So welcome. Thanks for joining us and being here and being a part of it.
Thanks so much for having me, Daniel. It's I enjoyed my time in person at the Upper House, and I'm glad to join you virtually today.
Yes, that's awesome. Well, Craig, I just want to jump right in. I want to get a little bit of your background. You have a very interesting background, and so excited to kind of walk through a few of those things for our listeners, which I think will set up the rest of our conversation here today. But what kind of first sparked your passion for filmmaking, storytelling, and what is a little bit of your journey as a filmmaker and in the kind of the film industry over the years?
I think I came to movies mostly as a fan. You know, my mom would, I grew up in Florida, at South Florida. It was really hot in the summer. So I think she was looking for an escape in the movies, take me and my brother and sister. So I grew up on probably Disney's worst era of filmmaking. But I also, even when I would come home from school, again, it was 3-4 o'clock, it would be so hot that I would just like sit in front of, we had, you know, one of those wall air conditioners, and I would like sit in front of the air conditioner and watch TV. And I would just watch for like whatever old movie was on in the afternoons. And so I kind of grew up on the black and white classics, which probably tells you a little bit about, you know, this white hair. Maybe that's more, you know, like I'm actually that old, that ancient. But, you know, things like Casablanca and Humphrey Bogart, you know, old Westerns, you know, all that kind of thing, spy thrillers from the 60s, kind of Cold War thrillers. I was just, I actually grew up just watching all that stuff and digging. I think I liked the escape. The movies, in a sense, are a transportation device. And so it transported me like out of that hot box into whatever, you know, exotic spaces I was seeing, you know, in these films, in these not necessarily imaginary world, but maybe heightened world.
Yeah. So how did you transition from that to kind of film as a vocation, right? I mean, you have kind of this background of just as a loving it, loving the medium, loving the thing. But then was there a moment, or was it just kind of a process in which you all of a sudden were like, oh, okay, this is going to be, this is actually my vocation and calling, and I want to kind of dive into this more in kind of the structure of kind of your life path.
Oddly enough, it occurred in a seminary class where it was a class, I believe, on like theology and pop culture. It was taught by a professor, Australian professor, Rob Banks at Fuller Seminary. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of bemoaning the fact that he didn't pursue storytelling and filmmaking as a career, that it was kind of his first love, but he just really didn't think it was possible. And he brought a guest in named Coleman Luck, who was a TV producer at the time. He was one of the showrunners of The Equalizer, the original version, not the Queen Latifah version, but the original version on CBS. And that guy was this kind of crusty, grizzled Vietnam vet who saw everything in that, in those kinds of terms. And he kind of said, like, if you really want to get dirty, if you want to get in the mess, you come join me in Hollywood. Who's got the guts? And I was like sitting in the back and I was like, that sounds great. I just like volunteered, like, yes, I will go. And he was like, talk to me after class, kid. So, you know, he just like kind of ran out of class because he had to get over to the studio. And he just was like, okay, have you ever written anything? I was like, no, not really. He's like, okay, start writing. He's like, I got a fellowship group, a writer's creative group meets at my house, you know, once a month. He's like, you know, here's my number. You should join us. And it was just like, okay. And that was that. And so I responded to his literal call. The group was called Premise, and it was a group of writers, directors, producers, all Christians who, you know, had over time a whole bunch of success. I mean, one of the people in the group was the producer of Touched by an Angel for, you know, a decade. You had the screenwriters eventually of Batman Forever. And so I learned from them. They were forerunners to a large degree, and they showed me that it was actually quite possible.
Yeah. You have a really interesting educational background, like really this interesting mix of both like film and theology, which I don't know many people. I mean, you were naming a few, but there's probably not a ton of people that are, you know, kind of have that mix of education background. Talk to us a little bit about why those two things and how do you see them kind of come together in marriage together?
Well, marriage is an interesting word. I am one of the few people who could probably marry, bury, baptize, or direct, depending on what you're looking for on a given day. You know, it's like I could be in this, I could perform the ceremony, or I could film it. You know, maybe both, but yeah, probably not. Probably need to separate those roles. I think a lot of people maybe saw it as an either or, like you can do this or you can do that. And I was like, well, if I love God and love movies, why can't I integrate them? Why do I have to separate? So I essentially joined together what many have thought should be asunder, and consistently saw, well, let me put it this way. If you think about the greatest films, they're almost all rooted in life's ultimate questions. Mm-hmm. And so the areas that theology likes to tread, I think, are where the best films and the most resonant universal themes come out of. And so I never saw them as competing, but complementary. And frankly, now having been a professor, you know, both as a film professor as well as a professor at Fuller Seminary, I've taught many people who've done both and put those things together. And so I think we've reunited what some thought were separate spheres.
Yeah. Why is the medium of film such a compelling storytelling kind of mechanism for us? Why does it just kind of grip us so well?
Well, one, because we give it our undivided attention. At its best, right? You literally pay money, set aside time to go sit in the dark with other people around this kind of electronic campfire. And you consequently, I think, tend to give more of yourself to it. You are fairly present, at least in the old days when we weren't kind of doing the second screen thing, you know, in our own homes with our computers or our phones. So I think attending to something and suspending disbelief and sitting with someone else's dilemma, I think is a deeply human and humanizing activity.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a, I think of just the great films that we see, and so many people will describe like a really moving, compelling thing that's actually in a theater. You know, very rarely do you see someone be like, yeah, I was watching this movie at home with my home system and it was great, you know, kind of. You never hear people like have this transformational experience at home. It's always going to someplace. Your thought about the campfire, right? Like we're all watching and engaging, laughing together, crying together, having these kind of really emotional responses, which I think is just a really compelling way to just experience life, experience storytelling. It's really a positive attribute.
Well, and it's like, what are you buying when you're buying that ticket? What is it you're seeking? You know, when you're buying a comedy, it might be that you are a little depressed and you need some laughs. You need The Naked Gun or something silly. When you're entering into drama, maybe you're processing, I don't know, some grief and some trauma, and you're not quite sure how to get through it or if you'll get through it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you buy a ticket to a film called There Will Be Blood, right? You literally go up to the box office and say, "There will be blood, please." You know, so you're like asking for, you know, to be traumatized by the film. Yeah. He literally promises you there will be blood. So get ready, you know?
Yeah.
So I just think there is a transaction there. There's a seeking involved in leaving the house and searching for something specific.
Yeah.
Even if it's an escape, even if it's like my life's too intense, I just need an escape. That's fine. You're in a sense buying time. You're buying time away from your life, I think, in many ways, to process your life.
Mm-hmm. So the media industry is rapidly changing. Crazy how it's changing. I mean, COVID, obviously, I think accelerated some things in the media industry that were already present, but it just kind of pushed it out of gas to the fire a little bit on some stuff. We had the strike. You know, there's things that have happened here over the last few years that have been real difficult. As you see the landscape right now, kind of the film industry landscape, what do you think is working and what do you think is not working when you kind of take a look at that?
Well, in many ways, we had a good summer at the box office. I think we had maybe some better superhero films. I think the Superman movie and the Fantastic Four, both highly enjoyable. You have, I think, some deep films like Sinners, 28 years later, both of them dealing with like zombies and death. They both kind of have this sort of pandemic-y kind of commentary about the undead and virus and infections and that type of thing. So I think we're still processing that pandemic experience. I think we're still in a little bit of that collective grief that we didn't quite maybe deal with because we couldn't go to funerals. People died and we didn't really get a chance to recognize it, to sit with it in a certain kind of way. And yeah, technology, of course, has accelerated both who can make films, how they're consumed, literally, and how they, in a sense, consume us. I feel like now we're almost never off or away from our phones, or at least from these kind of storytelling devices. We're streaming all day. So it's like we never really read books anymore, but we're constantly reading and we're constantly getting news and inputs. And so I'd say we're more entertained than ever. Mm-hmm. And so then the need to step away to get entertainment, I think, has kind of vanished because it's all available all the time. So that special appointment that you make with a theater or with a show has gone away. Mm-hmm. And so it's all, instead of it was the industry, in a sense, used to push their shows towards you. Now everything is pull. You can get anything you want. Pull it down from the internet almost anytime, anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think like the funding mechanisms have changed drastically, right? I mean, big blockbuster, you know, that was the mechanism to make money back. You have so many little independent filmmakers who are producing really amazing content, and choosing the platforms to distribute on are very different, right? So you have something on let's say, if they would get maybe a Netflix or something else as a small kind of independent thing, which probably has some funding mechanisms, versus like a true indie type of a dynamic. And then they're just uploading it to YouTube, right? And like, that's the mechanism in which they're doing that. You were a part of this Windrider thing that was created and still are a part of that. I think it's a really interesting model. Can you just describe a little bit about what Windrider is? What, you know, kind of what was the genesis for creating that? And then what are you guys doing now with that kind of program?
Yes, we've been taking students to the Sundance Film Festival in kind of a, I would call it like a guided tour, as a kind of an easy entry. We've been doing that for 20 years now.
Wow.
And we've always had both aspiring filmmakers and future theologians, ministers, and we've put them together in a sense, the same class. And it started with maybe 30 people, and now we're over 300. We have people from about 50 different colleges and universities, most of them faith affiliated, but not exclusively. And we have formed, in a sense, the largest ticket buying block of any group at the Sundance Film Festival. So when you show up with, you know, 300 young people who are going to see 10 films each, that's like 3,000 tickets that we're buying. And that's both a lot of buying power and a lot of calendars to coordinate.
Yeah, that's so cool. That's such a fun opportunity for students to get engaged, right?
And yeah. Well, we become like first responders in the audience because you're seeing a world premiere.
Right.
And so the filmmaker really doesn't know how it's going to be received, doesn't really know what questions it'll prompt. And so as an audience, we become part of even forming that public discussion through the questions that we ask. And again, filmmakers are like, how many students do you have? Well, they're from all over America, all over the world. Wow. Can I come talk to you guys? Right. So we initially thought like it was us on the outside kind of looking in. And now after 20 years, they're asking us, can I please speak? You know, can I have a private conversation with your little group of, you know, 300 aspiring storytellers?
That's cool. That's cool. So summer is approaching close. You know, we're got about a month left here. What films should we be watching this summer? What's, if you could say, hey, maybe here are three things that we should be watching over the next month as summer kind of comes to an end, what would those things be?
Well, the film Sketch is, I think, perhaps one of the most original films of the summer. It's a bit of a throwback to kind of that 80s, maybe Goonies / Gremlins kind of vibe. It's got the Spielbergian kind of innocence and fun of kids, but it also has some scares and some chills. And it's also about the role of creativity and art in how we process grief. And it's doing all of that in a highly original way. And I'm just so proud of the filmmakers. Tony Hale stars in it, and he's, of course, one of the producers. But you have a new filmmaker named Seth Worley, who's carved his teeth on music videos and commercials and just lets his imagination go in this film in a way that I think will surprise people. And they'll just be like, yeah, can we have more of that? You know, and it's an independent film. It was financed by the Wonder Project. And it does evoke wonder, I think, in the audience, which is the best of both summer movies. You know, it's always been like sci-fi special effects, you know, like Jurassic dinosaurs or, you know, superheroes. But this is a little smaller scale. It's really just focusing on one family and one little girl whose monsters, you know, her notebook comes to life.
That's cool.
Sketch. That's what it's called.
Yeah. What else? What else would you and prompt us to be watching?
Well, if you didn't catch the Superman or Fantastic Four movies, I recommend them both. What they've done is I think they're getting away from the established formula a bit. They're not origin stories. They are both, in a sense, already assume that these superheroes exist. Because we've seen that origin story over and over, you know. Mm-hmm. Caught in the gamma rays, the person, you know, the unlikely hero. And they're also, neither one of them is cynical. They're actually both sincere. And, you know, even the Superman film, it posits that, you know, kindness would be perhaps the new punk rock. that in an age of just endless kind of vitriol and hate being hurled on both sides, someone coming in with decency and care is like, whoa, that's radical. You know, what's up with you, Superman? Like, you're weird. But it's a kind of a punk rock move to bring kindness forth and to say, I care about my fellow human, or my fellow superhuman in this case.
That's really cool. Anything this fall that you're looking forward to coming out that you would be like, oh, you should definitely put that one on your calendar?
Well, you know, I'm of an age where Bruce Springsteen was a very formative figure. And so there's a Bruce Springsteen biopic coming out this fall based on his highly acoustic album, Nebraska, called Deliver Me From Nowhere, that I expect to be very soulful, very touching, kind of get to the heart of what it means to be an artist, how hard and painful it can be. I think Nebraska was in many ways Springsteen's most personal album and revealed a side of him that we just maybe didn't know. We were used to kind of the stadium rocking, you know, born in the USA kind of guy. And this is Nebraska was something else, deeply personal. I actually attended a wedding in New Jersey this summer. So I actually went back and saw the house that Springsteen grew up in Freehold, New Jersey. He lived in like a little duplex. His dad worked at the plant, definitely drank too much. A lot of scary nights, I think, for young Bruce Springsteen. And how do you process that, you know, as an adult looking back? When do you look at it and how do you look at it? Also went, I went to E Street where they rehearsed and actually saw the garage that the band practiced in, not far from 10th Avenue of 10th Avenue Freeze Out fame, which is a song about the band itself. And it just could not have been a smaller garage. I mean, like, there's big garages for a large garage band. This was a tiny garage. And the reason they chose the name E Street is because they were often waiting on their keyboardist to show up. It was his mom's garage in the back of the house. And so they were like, we're really more like playing on the street, just like waiting. Yeah. And that's where the E Street name came from, because we're just standing outside hoping the garage door is going to open here in a minute. And so when you see that, you think about, you know, millions of songs and concerts and fans, you know, you just realize all these artists, you know, we all have sort of a dream. We're all just someone trying to process whatever complex things that childhood, adolescence, love, longing, all of those things. What does that mean? And how do we get that? Deliver Me From Nowhere. I think it comes in September.
The podcast notes for today's conversation include a link to view this episode on YouTube. Remember to follow or subscribe to stay updated with our latest episodes in your podcast app.
So, you know, one of the interesting pieces, I think, being in kind of ministry and church world, you know, lots of different forms of ministry, big C church kind of dynamics of things, is you see this really interesting sacred secular kind of divide sometimes, right? Around like, oh, okay, well, you know, these forms of things are okay, these forms are not okay, type of a deal. I think this next generation that is definitely loosened, right? But for a while, and I think there are people, especially in my generation, that's very much kind of the gripping thing, like, you know, what should we do? What should we consume? What should we consume? So for you as a Christian, a person of faith, where do you think about, and where would you encourage us as we think about kind of more like secular media? I'll use that term in quotes for people that are listening. But where do you think we should find value in that? And then maybe where should be some guardrails for us as we kind of think about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I only would ever use the word Christian as a noun, not an adjective. So in a sense, I would say there's no such thing as Christian media or Christian music. There's music made by Christians. Okay. Yep. You distinguish that. But otherwise, you're just kind of using a marketing term, I think, that is distancing and maybe creates a false divide in our minds, because I also don't want to separate my Sunday morning experience from my, you know, Monday to Saturday experience. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be so removed that I can't figure out how it applies or how to put into practice or to make worship, in a sense, a lifestyle, not an event, right? So even that, those words, secular and sacred, it's like, I actually don't use those words. I guess because, again, I'm trying to look at creation itself and say, well, it's all holy, or it's all been created by a creator to be beautiful and glorious. Sure, it's fallen, right? You know, we have to deal with death. We have to deal with painful realities of floods and fires and all of those kinds of things. But the beauty of, you know, a flower, a bird, a song that they may be singing, I want to have eyes to see and ears to hear that. And so if I'm kind of constantly separating things and prejudging them and saying, well, I don't know, that one, the sourcing on that, it seems questionable. Mm-hmm. I may be shutting myself off to both natural theology and the general revelation that comes, you know, from the stars and from creation. Psalm 19, you know, celebrates six verses of the glory of God's creation. And then it talks about the specifics, the special revelation of the law of God, and in a sense, maybe how Jesus will go on to fulfill that. So I don't want to separate what Psalm 19 puts together. General revelation, special revelation, nature, as well as God's revealed laws and glories brought together holistically in Christ. Right? Yeah. Again, God with us, not without us. Emmanuel is God with us. And so I don't want to look at God as somehow separate from us, but as proximate to us.
Yeah. When maybe in a recent, you know, sometime this summer recently, did you profoundly like see a connection in a film that you were unexpectedly seeing of faith or redemption or, you know, something along kind of those lines of kind of how we live out our faith that you just did not expect seeing within the context of, you know, a film that you had seen recently?
Well, the film Sinners actually opened on a Good Friday, and it's a pretty dark film. The characters are named Smoke and Stack. They engage in lots of questionable behavior. You've got a blues guitarist who, in a sense, leaves the church to go play the blues. So there's a lot of choices being made, a lot of temptations proffered. It's a very sexy film. It's a very violent film. There's, you know, there's vampires. There's, but what it talks about is the danger of inviting those vampires into your life. It's about how we dance with temptation and perhaps make room for the devil. And so in that sense, I'd call it a very cautionary tale. It has roots, I think, in kind of legends around Robert Johnson, the blues guitarist who allegedly sold his soul to the devil to learn how to play and to become the greatest blues guitarist of his era. And so it's like, what price, you know, will, how much will you risk of your own soul for the sake of a song or a prophet or a good night out of dancing? You know, there's these glorious moments, musical moments in the film, but then you start to see the wages of sin, both, you know, kind of generationally and culturally. And there's some pretty hairy things that happen in the end where you're like, yikes. But in the midst of all that, there's also these scenes that I think echo like the Pietà of Michelangelo, a tenderness between mother and child, a family uniting in grief about a lost baby. And so I was surprisingly tender amidst a lot of sex and violence. And I think in that sense, it reflects Ryan Coogler taking those questions of temptation and sin seriously. Again, it's called Sinners. You're going to see some sin.
Yeah, right.
So he's promising you that in the title. But what do you find on the other side? And can you learn how to resist temptation?
Yeah. Well, I want to transition a little bit into kind of talking a little bit about technology. I mean, it's definitely shaping the industries that you're in. It's shaping all of our lives drastically. You know, I always think about, you know, technology is not either good nor bad, but it does form us, right? And so as you're thinking about, you know, culture and theology and all the things, all the places that you're a part of, how do you see technology influencing your understanding of spirituality and identity today as you think about all the kind of the tools that are before us?
Mm-hmm. I'd say it's the greatest challenge of our time. It's actually, I think, the largest culture-shaping institution now. I think it's supplanted entertainment because it's challenging how we live, even moment by moment. The constant distraction, the interruption, the setting of an agenda, you know, the little red buttons, the things we click on, the ways that texts interrupt whatever it is, whatever train of thought we might have. We're almost never apart from it. Many people basically start their day and end their day with their phone. And so, you know, 1,000 years ago, it was about praying the hours. And now it's sort of attending to the texts and the tweets. Mm-hmm. And that's a real rethinking of what it means to be human and where we take our, where our prompts come from, I would say. And so it takes a lot of work, I think, to not be run by the i-gods of technology who set their own agenda and their own pace, which is now. I demand your attention now.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. I was having a conversation with someone recently. They were talking about their TikTok algorithm and how terrible it was. And I was like, well, you just change it. And they're like, what? What do you mean? And I'm like, well, no, just change it. Like, just start liking and engaging with other types of content and you'll see it drastically change, right? About how, and it will, it'll be a matter of minutes, right? All of a sudden it's serving up, you know, all these heartwarming, right? Pieces of content based upon what is happening in the mix. I think of people that feel, you know, this grappling with kind of this gripping kind of sensation with technology, like just feels like it's in, closing in on me all the time. And, you know, I don't, and I'm like, well, change your algorithm, right? Like change the way that you think about and how you engage with the things that are around you and to do that. So as we're thinking about that, are there any tools or any things that you think about and ways that help us kind of manage some of these pieces in our lives?
Yeah, well, I think it starts by recognizing the algorithmic authority that we've invested in a lot of these tech companies. I think all too often we say, well, this thing is doing this thing to me. And we don't realize, like, well, there is this little off switch. Now, there are, you know, filters that you could apply. So in a sense, we've sort of outsourced or already given up a lot of our own authority and our own power. And so a lot of it, I think, is taking back our power, taking control of our own interaction with these things. I think the ability to do a digital detox, to have regular time away. I mean, there's a reason why a Sabbath, right, was established as a kind of a reset, a weekly reset. And I don't think many of us take a digital Sabbath. I think we tend to just kind of let it roll. And we don't think about the rhythms of a week. And so I've been encouraged to some degree by the generation below me, by my own kids. You know, my daughter will go off of, she'll delete her Instagram account, you know, every 3 months or 6 months. She'll just be like, it's too toxic. I want out. And she'll just shut it down. Now, of course, then it gets really hard because she's like, oh, my friends are on there and I'm missing what's going on, you know, and that's the danger, right, is that there's such a monopoly created by the eye gods that says you've got to do this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the creators of Google, one thing they had in common, Larry and Sergey, they both went to Montessori schools. So they went to these like tactile schools that had no technology. It was all about like how you can manipulate your world physically and how do you play with stuff. You know, Steve Jobs famously didn't give his kids, you know, iPhones and iPads. He wanted the things he's saying you must have. He's like, nah, I don't have that in my house. I don't want my kids playing with that stuff. I don't want them to get addicted. So in that sense, the iGods, I think, are quite disingenuous, kind of helping us, making us feel like we have to have it or we will be left behind. When in fact, with their own kids, they think by not having it, my kids now have a competitive creative advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you see AI changing the film industry? What's happening right now? How are things? You know, we see AI popping up in every part of our lives. I think there's a lot of fear around AI in the film industry. What's happening right now as you kind of take a look at kind of a blanketed approach and what's happening within that space?
Yeah, it is such an important issue that that's why I wrote my most recent book, Honest Creativity, because I saw so much anxiety amongst the creative class. And I think that anxiety has since crossed over into computer programmers and, you know, accountants and financial analysts and lawyers. And I think we're all dealing with it a little bit. With the film industry, to a large degree, the recent strike was really about that. That was screenwriters not wanting to be replaced. That's actors saying, you can't use my likeness without my permission. Yep. You have to pay me. So, you know, that notion of consent and compensation, very important for creative moving forward. Probably the upside of AI is that you can prototype things quicker, faster, and cheaper using AI. So if you want to sort of say it might look like this or it might sound like this, you can approximate what it is you'd like to do. Create that kind of showreel or that pitch deck, right?
Yeah.
And right. Mid-Journey or something like that.
You can do
it very easily. Where it, I think we'll catch up with all of us as AI becomes a standard looking tool or trick. We're already seeing a lot of folks would call it AI slop, where you can just tell it's fake and it feels fake and it doesn't move you because it feels inhuman. And so at some point, right, and maybe sooner rather than later, we'll already start to say, that uncanny valley does not move me. Because I can tell that it's not right. I see it on social media a lot. There's now all these AI-generated articles and AI-generated photos. It's like, well, that's not real. They did not meet. They didn't have a gathering together.
Yeah.
So the need for discernment, I feel like, is going to rise to even higher levels moving forward.
Yeah. It was interesting. I was talking with some other like kind of creative people. And we were having this conversation and, you know, obviously there's fear around it, but I said, I think it actually will enhance us. Like as creatives, I think it'll actually enhance, make us better at whatever medium, whatever thing that we're doing. You know, right now AI is running in the background of this, right? And helping us sound really great and look really great. That's a help, right? In the mix of things. And so I do think there's the fear of, okay, is this going to replace me, right? And there are industries that will drastically be impacted. But like, you still need somebody to shoot and light things really well and great storytellers and, you know, great editors. You know, AI can't edit a whole thing by itself. And so I think it will enhance. I'm hoping that it enhances kind of the creative process in which we live and how we're operating things.
Well, and I'm actually bullish on live performers. I feel like if you can manipulate your own physical body as an actor, as a dancer, as a musician, you're going to actually be rare. Because all those things that take, you know, thousands of hours of practice, when you actually put in the time, people will be like, oh, wow, that's real. You know, that person's in front of me doing this physically. It's not digital. And so I think that kind of tactile experience. Same thing with painters, right? Someone who can actually put the paint on the canvas. Same thing with plumbers. You know, plumbers are going to get even more valuable because somebody needs to manipulate the physical world. Mm-hmm. And so anybody who has that kind of tactile job, I feel like their stock may rise long term.
Yep. Just as we wrap up, just a couple of closing kind of questions here. But what is one belief that you've kind of changed your mind on in regarding faith and technology, maybe in the last 5 years?
I think I've probably lost more faith in technology. I think I look at, you know, what's happened with people's attention span and ability to focus, and I'm just like, I'm not sure this is going the right direction. I'm not sure we're getting more patient, more loving, more kind. And so if that's true, then it's like, I think I might need to be actively resisting what big tech is selling. I think I was a little more hopeful, perhaps, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now that I've seen, in a sense, also their boundless greed. In the early days, it was like, oh, we're just going to connect people. Well, now you've created the algorithms and such that you won't even let us share articles that take people out of your own system. You've made it less attractive, whether it's LinkedIn or, you know, Twitter. You know, it used to be when you posted an article, you could really see the article, see the picture. Yeah. Now it's like, oh, I'm just going to hide it and make it smaller. So I just hold on to your attention. So that entertaining as a negative, right, meaning to hold, I think that is what we've seen a lot of big tech do, is just try to hold our attention, which is not a gracious activity. It's kind of a desperate grab or capture. And it's like, that is not right.
There's a lot of creatives that, you know, writers, people in kind of lots of different industries that listen to this. As we close, how would you encourage for honest creativity to be expressed in kind of the day and age that we're in right now?
Well, I'm going to be a long-term, a big believer, not in AI, but in HI, in human ingenuity, human imagination. That's not going to go out of style. And whether that means humor, whether it means pathos, right? Those ancient two masks, I think will always be something distinctive about us, the expressing joy, expressing pain. That is art at its best, creates this bridge and makes us feel a little less alone in our struggles and in our triumphs. And that's not going to ever go away. And so I would just be encouraged people to continue to lean into color and light and words and songs and notes and images. Yeah, just keep going. It's fine. The tools may change, but people's longing for genuine connection will not.
Yeah. Well, Craig, thank you so much for being on the Upwards podcast. We're so delighted to have our connection with you, and I have a personal connection with you over the years. And so it's just so fun to have this conversation. And we hope to have you back at Upper House sometime in the future.
Well, thanks so much, Daniel. Keep up the great work. Love the Upper House team. Have a great fall, great school year, and keep inspiring us all.
Thank you for tuning into the Upwards podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For more information about the S.L. Brown Foundation and Upper House, please visit slbf.org. Go in peace to be a light on our campuses, in our churches, and in our businesses so that all may flourish.